Welcome everybody to the first of series of podcasts for 2013. My name is Tony DeBolfo, the club's journalist and historian at Visy Park, and it's a great pleasure of mine to introduce our first guest for 2013 who's with us today. He wore the number 10 made famous by Paddy O'Brien, Jim Francis, Fred Stafford and Johnny James. His senior playing career spanned 9 seasons and 165 senior games, 3 of them the famous grand finals of 1968, 70 and 72. He's also part of that elite group of players to have landed a club best and fairest in a premiership season, 1970, and was not surprisingly elevated to the Carlton Hall of Fame and the coveted team of the 20th century as first Rover. As a rover to the stars, he was part of that unforgettable following division, which included a couple of handy types in John Nicholls and Sergio Silvani. He was famously the blush to Percy Jones's stutter, but will readily answer to the call of gags. He is, of course, Adrian Gallagher, and he is here in the studio with us today. Welcome, Adrian.
Thanks very much, Tony. It's great to be talking with you in the Bruce Dool media room.
It's a little bit of a contradiction in terms, gags, isn't it? But we'll run with it.
Well, when I saw it over the door, I've gone, Bruce would like this.
Now, Adrian, there's a fair bit of ground to cover. And, of course, the story really doesn't begin with your senior debut in 1964 because you're actually the only player in Carlton history to have progressed through 5 grades here at the club, under-15s, under-17s, under-19s, reserves and seniors. I think Dennis Pagan might have got close. He came through 4 of them,
yes,
didn't
Dennis.
Quite break through at senior level.
Well, he had this sort of long-running association with Ron Barassi that Ron went, Dennis was, and he moved on. I don't know what, Ron's selection of sort of Dennis out in that regard. But we played together in the under-15s, Carlton Fifths back then. My parents, we lived down in Yarram as a young boy. I grew up down there, down in South Gippsland there, and my dad moved up with work to Mount Royal Hospital for the Aged over the back here past the zoo, and he declared to us that our team that we were going to follow was Carlton because it was the closest ground to home. We lived on the premises at Mount Royal Hospital for the Aged, so I was one of the rare players to be recruited out of an aged care facility.
Now, Gags, who made the first overtures from the club to get you across to Carlton?
Well, Tony, that just following on from what I'm saying is that back then it was zoning was in place. And the zone of Carlton then was Park Street, just over here, with McAllister and the grounds going down there, and Sydney Road. So you had to be in Carlton's area sort of thing and to play for Carlton. So really I've come out of not only the aged home but Tarana Boys Home and Mont Park and the zoo and the golf course. So as it turned out, as I said to you, that Dad announced that we're going to barrack for Carlton. And so he said that they've got an under-15 side, so I want you to go out and try out. This is how it happened. So out the front here in Royal Parade there, he dropped me off one night, training starting under the gum tree that's still there. And I'm watching these boys up, going up and down, doing, you know, lane work and this sort of thing. I've got, being a bit shy from Yarram, you know, God, this is a bit hard. So I've waited behind the tree, watched them. And Dad turned up about, you know, tea time, ready to go home for tea. He said, how'd you go? I said, I don't think I'm ready for it yet. So that year we just spent watching Carlton, and in one of the photos here, there's the press box, the old press box there. We watched Carlton play. We went along to all the games, and the next year Dad became manager of the Fifths, so I had to go. I had to go to training. So that's how I started.
You've got a lot to thank your father for. Did he live long enough to see the triumphs, you know, at senior level?
Yes. That was one of the most pleasing things about it. Yeah, that he right through. It was really good. He to keep his involvement, just as an example of it, because it went up to the Force, and then the big one was the under-19s. You know, playing in the under-19s, and he became timekeeper. So he kept his involvement, and my three younger sisters come along and my mum. So we made up the crowd at the under-19s with our dog.
What was your father's name for the record?
Cyril.
Cyril. What a great man. And you, I know you've related these stories to me before, but you have fond memories of sitting, I think, in the Heatley stand and watching Carlton play as a supporter, as a kid. What are your overriding memories of the players you saw in that particular period?
Well, as I was saying, the first game in 1959 that we did go along to, and that was where we stood in front of the press box there, was Carlton playing Essendon. And Sergio Silvani wearing the long sleeves, the socks down, wearing number one, was at full forward. Very young Serge. I think it was either his first or second year. Well, he's kicked six. He's kicked six of those big torpedoes winding around and going straight through. So he's always been my favourite player, you know, from that day.
Who would have thought, you know, you'd be settling up alongside him with Big Nick calling the shots from the centre bounce.
I think of that quite often. When I'm talking with Serge, you know, and remember that. And then we'd... We progressed to the, it wasn't the Heatley because that was very exclusive. We got into the Gardner stand. Dad reserved some seats in the Gardner stand. And throughout my period, my sisters and my mum and dad watched the game. So, you know, like I started off watching them there when I played in the morning and came to the footy in the afternoon. So it was just a great day. And I had my sisters collect all the Tarax bottles so we could cash them in on the way home, you know. So I was trying to work some business into it too.
Now, in 1963, clearly a big year for you, Adrian. You were judged best player of field, I think, in the premiership victory, the grand final victory of 63. You won the club's BNF, I think, at that level as well, and you finished third in the Morrish.
Yeah, no, I had... you know, I had a good year then. I was 16. Tommy Brooker was a great coach then. And the next year went up in 1964 was my first season under Ken Hands. But to win a premiership, you know, it was a lot different back then in regards to the underage sides. You know, like, to be honest, it was hard actually coming up through the underage side. It was not actually many people did. I'm not saying that, you know, not big noting here or whatever, but it was the ones from the country got the big one. I mean, back then there was always the stars from the country. It sounds like I'm a bit bitter on this, but that's not really. But it was, you sort of had to earn your stripes if you were a local boy because you were signed. You couldn't play for anyone else.
You're in the system.
You're in the system, so it was... That was it. So you really had to prove yourself, and fortunately enough, I was able to work my way up and get a go under Ken Hands, which was a great experience in 64.
64. And Jack Carney, kicker Carney, I think, might have coached in the reserves as well.
Yes, Jack Carney was coach of the reserves. Great Carlton man, great going back many years. And Ken Hands, of course, was... actually, he was a good friend of my father's too, and he was a great man and a great Carlton person. And, you know, I was very, you know, I've had a good relationship with Ken over the years and fantastic Carlton person.
Well, talk about Ken Hands, your first senior coach. What were your thoughts when, you know, the Barassi coup and, you know, Ken Hands had to make way? What was your overriding feeling? You're only a young bloke then, and you'd only been a senior player for a year, less than a year. Were you actually happy for the changeover, or were you disappointed that Ken was being replaced?
Well, at that time, Tony, I was pretty young and that sort of thing, and Ron Barassi was easily the biggest name in football and was probably the first taste of Carlton politics, if you... which have gone on, got more experienced at it. Excuse me.
They say you gags more than one person in the room, you've got a political situation.
At Carlton. Well, you know what it means. And so that is my memory of it. It was, you know, like Ken Hands, just a great player, but I suppose I'm stuck for words here. I'm nearly going to say, like, I mean, Brett Ratton's a great Carlton man. and we need Mick to go the one step further. Maybe that's the way they thought then, you know, maybe like now, just as a comparison. Well, as it proved, Ron Barassi was the best thing that happened to Carlton in 150 years we've been going, I think, other than Chris Judd coming.
I think even Hedgie would begrudgingly concede that too.
Yeah.
I'm going to get to the 64 year, your first year as a senior player, but the number 10, did you have a choice over what Guernsey number you were given, or were you just handed it?
No, there was the match committee selected which jumpers went to, which, you know, players and that sort of thing. And it was certainly a great honour to get Johnny James's number, you know, 61 Brownlow medalist. And it was certainly a great honour to receive that. And it was the 100th year, Carlton's 100th year. So we had the centenary at the Southern Cross, which Sir Robert Menzies presented it, meaning the jumper at the Southern Cross, which, you know, as a 17-year-old, was pretty impressive.
And, of course, Matty Watson wears the number 10 now. I guess you follow the number with interest and see the wear of the number and how he's faring.
Yeah, I think most players would. I do anyway, and watch the young fella, and he's got the left foot, and I was a left footer myself. So, yeah, no, hopefully he has a good career and a long career, Carl, but you definitely do watch the player that... that takes your number.
Absolutely. Now, you made your debut in the sixth round of 64. You were actually sharing the bench with Kevin Hall that day. I had a look at the game. Frosty Miller was named at full forward in that particular game. Was St Kilda at the Junction Oval, and your team was basically overrun in the last quarter. I think St Kilda finished on pretty strongly. And interestingly enough, Gordon Collis and Berkeley Cox were both reported in that game, and Berkeley copped 4 weeks for whacking Carl Dittrich. He obviously had no sense of self-preservation, Berkeley Cox.
Well, Barclay Cox was wearing the number 9. I had the locker next to him, number 10, and John Gould was on the other side. Well, he was one of my favourites, Barclay, but he was quite fiery. He was only 5'9" too, so he had to reach up to get Carl. And he used to give me one of those at training. He said, "What was that?" I turned around. He said, "Well, you're going to get him in a game, so you might as well learn him at practice." It was a bit of a hard way to get through training, watching out for Barclay Cox's elbows.
Absolutely. And, of course, you played in that game, I think, alongside both Nick and Maury Sankey. I mean, Maury Sankey, you would have roved perhaps in the early days to Maury. And what sort of a player was he? And do you remember, you know, the impact that his loss had on the club? It was a terrible thing, the accident he had.
Yes, it was, well, it was my first experience. That's why, you know, I always remember it, the first experience of someone close to you that passed away in such a tragic circumstances. And he was, you know, for a young player, he was so important around the club as he's... His personality had a very vibrant and strong personality. That was probably his greatest attribute. You know, he was, as a footballer, he was a good player, and came from Tasmania. And but his main influence was he was the character, he was the life of the party and on training and that sort of thing. Excuse me. That he, you know, was such a tragedy. Mm. But that game, I was on the bench there, and you know, like there was no interchange or anything like that. So when you came off, I had the choice of lining up on Eric Guy. Well, he was near me anyway, and a bloke called Guyot. Oh, no, I just looked at them and I was petrified, seriously.
You made it through. You did make it through.
Yeah.
And, of course, time went on. You found your feet clearly. And, of course, you were there privy to, you know, the Barassi years. And do you remember the impact that Barassi made? Was it from day one? Can you remember, you know, the lay of the land as it was when he walked in the door for the first time?
Absolutely, Tony. I mean, he was the biggest thing in football. Then he was on the Tarak show even, you know, showing us how to kick and had very white laces. I can remember that as a kid. But, no, Barassi, he... moulded us into, you know, wanting the only thing was to win premierships. I mean, if you talk to anyone in our era, and that hopefully we pass that on to McClure's and the Buckley's, and then they pass it on to the Kernahans. You know, and it comes a lot from, you know, from Barass of, you know, when we're running around this park, you know, that anyone who cut a corner, you know, Barass was, you'll never play in premierships if you cut a corner. And it was all directed, all his training, psychological instruction was all geared to training you to play in a premiership. And that's the difference. I mean, if you hear Robert Walls, who's, you know, a great commentator and stands out, I think, on TV when he's talking, a lot of his things are from Ron Barassi. I mean, when they talk about even Gerard Healy, who, you know, Brass coach, of marking the ball out in front of them, you know, like they have that, that's what you learn. That could make the difference in a grand final in the dying minutes. And as it turned out, Barassi training us with that discipline, look, he clashed with a lot of players, but he didn't mind that. He wanted you to come back and show him. And if he couldn't convince him, you did what he said. Mm. And he encouraged it. You know, like there was the Croswells and Jacksons. You know, they were strong characters, but Barassi trained them to play well. And really, 68, 70 was the classic example, the culmination of Barassi's philosophy and his training, and that geared us towards being able to do something like that, to come back. And all Barassi's sides had have that trait. And hopefully, I believe that was passed on to the younger players from senior players of Carlton. That's why we had such an excellent period of success.
Now, I want to ask you about the combination, you know, Nicol Silvani, Gallagher. It's probably one of, if not the most famous following combination in football history. Are you able to explain what it was about that combination that clicked? How would you describe it as part of that trio, that triumvirate that it worked? What was the secret to it?
Well, for the first thing I'd have to say, Tony, is I'm very happy to be included with the other two. But I think it was a mutual respect, which. You know, the initial side of it. I mean, we all played our part. I mean, Nichols was the key with the ruckman's the first use of the ball, but Silvani was so important with his blocking and also the alternative. And it will be interesting how they're changing the rules around the ground this year, of that art of Nichols' ruck work coming back, how players adjust to that. But Silvani was so important, and my role was to fit in with them. And I think my greatest attribute was probably my football brain or nous, or, you know, like being able to read the situation and fitting in with both those players. Because and it was the understanding in the experience that came together, and, you know, like working, each doing their role, you know, I think it made it pretty successful.
Do you volunteer Nick's name as the best Carlton player you played alongside or have seen?
Well, the most influential, you know, it all depends, you know, who's the most talented, you'd say, to be out of Croswell and Jeselenko, you know, like who'd take the best mark or whatever, with a Mackay, a close third, you know, like kick the kick before training. I mean, seriously, Sky Walker, you know, his marks are, you know, to be rated down the list, you know. This is only practice or training. Like, you had to watch out for flying objects, you know, with Croswell, Mackay and Jeselenko going for marks, you know, at kick to kick. But when you talk about Nichols comes in the category, and it's the same with Silvani, very close too. But Nichols' presence of the game, you knew it against other sides, and when he was bold. I mean, the closest for Carlton supporters today that you'd realise is when Chris Judd plays. I mean, Chris Judd has a persona about him, a presence, and that's what Nichols had. And he had it against other sides, and he had it, you know, with our sides, you know, like in the over the period, if you're comparing them with others, I mean, Lee Matthews was like that. Wayne Carey was like that. So just for people to get a bit of a gauge on how it was ranked, that's how Nichols was in his time. Mm. And he certainly gave us a, you know, when you ran out with behind the big number two with the tree trunks pounding down the race, you know, like you felt pretty good, you know. you had that added bit of confidence.
Absolutely. Now, you've played in the three premierships with Carlton, Adrian, beginning with 68. And, I mean, I'm sure that each one of those grand final victories is special in its own right. The 68 one, of course, the first premiership for Carlton in 21 years, a long time between drinks. But it was an ugly sort of contest. The wind had blown up and goals were hard to come by. I think you had the ball when the siren went, which was nice.
Yes, it was a good tackle. Wasn't it?
What are your recollections of the game itself?
Well, you are right. It was just so blustery, that northerly. It was a warm day and that northerly wind where the MCG, it was going everywhere. It didn't go in one direction. You know, it was just wind gust everywhere. And actually, it was the first, and well, it's the only time ever that the winning sides kicked less goals than the losing side. You know, it's an interesting little stat. And the four goals that Brian Kekovic kicked from full forward, I mean, can never be underestimated. I mean, he's kicked one from about 50 yards out down towards the Richmond, the punt road end, and there was a moved more than Massey's, you know, bowling it. Over at Lord's, but it went through. So, but the thing about 68 was that 21 years. I mean, I was 22. We were around, you know, not Jones and Jesus and all us. We were around 22. So, I mean, the thing that I noticed and was magnificent to play in, but it was the enjoyment that people got out of it, or the Carlton supporters, you know, and look. You know, and how many people would say to you, you know, like, we've waited that long. This is magnificent. And really, that was the thing I remember of 68, is the supporters and the people you knew, you know, the Carlton people, just saying how good it was, you know.
Now, fast forward to 2 years, 1970 grand final. Do you still ask yourself the question sometimes, how can you win a grand final? 44 points down at half time in Collingwood, biggest stage of the year. Do you still pinch your cheeks? Because that game to me seems to be surreal.
Well, I'm certainly glad we won it, Tony. Yeah, because the thing, you know, and everyone's asked this in your way, and there's a lot of versions of it. But what Ron Barassi said at half time,
did he say, Gags? You were there.
Well, this is my interpretation and verbatim. When we came in, I usually hid in the toilet, you know. let the coaches blast, get out of the way, you know. And Bruce had a pretty good one, and we're 44 points down, you know. So I could hear him saying, the whole thing was, is that, look, we've got the biggest thing is to just put up a performance, in that if you get beaten by Collingwood in this manner, you will never forget it for the rest of your life. And that was the first thing that I'd sunk into me. And he said, look, just relax. Now, and then the result of what we do, that brought us back to earth, that shock of, you know, like, imagine it. You know, imagine if Collingwood had beaten us by 100 points for the rest of your life. Well, that brought you back to reality. You go, goodness, forget about the 120,000 out there. Forget about this, forget about that. We've just got to do something and put it into place. And that's when he said, we've got to take risks. We've got to have a go and we've got to take risks. And to do that, we've got to have handball and attack from the back line. This is where the change of football. And because he had trained us and manipulated us to the way of his thinking on automatically doing what he said. You know, we're all individuals. He said, look, I want you to be an individual and be the best player, but you've got to do it in a team framework. Well, all that training that he's done worked, because when we've gone out there, there's a classic example of Peter Jones tackling Des Tutenham on the half forward flank down the punt road end on the outer side. He gets holding the ball. Well, his first thing is to play on, and he's gone across goal. He's got caught, and then the next thing, it's play on, and he's tackled the bloke again. He's got the ball back. He's done the same thing, gone across. Well, this time it went to Kevin Hall, and it went straight across the ground up the other side. I mean, this was unheard of. Mm. But this is a 6'6" ruckman from Tasmania, Hobart, who did what Barassi wanted.
Took the risks.
And actually, I think it was in the last quarter. But Walls, you know, that's what we did with those four goals. And, you know, that in the third quarter, of Wallsy handballing and over to Hopkins. And actually, Peter James Hoy said ever since that day, he dropped those two marks deliberately to fall into Hopkins' hands. I doubt that.
Now, you've often related the tale. I've heard it said about that goal that Jezelenko kicked in the last quarter to seal that game, the bouncy goal. Mm. And you were in probably as good a position as anyone to see it. Do you remember seeing the ball bounce? And
well, that's probably the most vivid memory of a, you know, like you don't usually get those periods in a game where you can, time stops, and where I was running up to that pack, and Jez has jumped up between Jerker and Jenkins and a couple of other Collingwood players, somehow got it on, thrown it on his left foot, and there's no one between them and the goals, and the ball's bounced. And it looked as though, this is what I'm saying, the period of time, it looks as though that Olympic stand, or the Ponsford stand, is it? The one behind the goals.
Ponsford
stand. It looks like they're coming out. It looks like they're going to land on the ground. I'm thinking, God, we're going to be invaded here. the crowd, when it bounced through, you know. So then you snapped out of it. But for that period, it just stopped while this ball bounced and bounced into the 10-yard square and then bounced through. It was amazing.
Is that game, I mean, does it stand out as the best? I mean, if you had to pick one of those three premierships you played in, do you have a favourite?
Look, well, you don't really. I mean, it's the obvious answer is, you know, it's like your children. You can't pick who's your favourite child.
Now, we have to move on, Gags, but we move to 72. Again, I mean, a famous victory, you know, 28 goals, 9, record score, still stands, masterstroke by Nichols to basically, you know, restructure the entire starting 18. And it was against a much hated opposition. a magnificent performance on the biggest day of the year.
Well, that's you know, as you asked there, you know, which is your favourite? You can go through each of them in just exactly with the same enthusiasm, Tony. I mean, they beat us four times that year, the Tigers.
That makes it sweet, doesn't it?
Well, the main thing is to win the big one.
Absolutely.
You know, like, and just to have, again, in, you know, with the way football's played today, to still hold that record of the number of games. And it was an attacking, you know, like Richmond's score was a good score too. So the style of game was just amazing.
Unbelievable. Now, digressing for a moment, Adrian, yourself, Ivan Rorten, Cole Kinnear share a great stat in that you're the only three living life members of both the Carlton Cricket and Football Clubs. You played in a premiership with the Carlton Cricket Club in 68, I think, which was the Football Club's premiership year as well. How far could you have gone with your cricket?
Well, very hard question there, Tony. But what I'd say about that is that when we were talking about the under 15s, I mean, I was that was in the winter, and in the summer I'd be coming up the Poplar Road over the road here and playing cricket in the under schoolboy side and the fourths and the thirds and the seconds and the first for Carlton and the cricket. So, I mean, I love both sports and. I think the simple answer is I think I was better at football. I think and Barass used to go berserk about training about the cricket, that silly game cricket. But I love playing cricket for Carlton and was fortunate to, you know, play in some good sides.
Mm. But now we are sort of, time is against us, and there's so much I'd love to ask, but there are a couple of things I would want to put to you, and you talk about, you know, the difference of opinion now and again that you might have had with the great Ronald Dale. That celebrated incident in April 1971 when you were ordered from the track for not completing 20 push-ups, and I think you were ruled out of the next game, by the coach. What happened there?
Oh, well, Tony, as I think you've, Keith Richards really summed it up best. He said, if you can remember the 70s, you weren't there. So I think that comes into it.
Very diplomatic.
One of them that, look, Brass and I, you know, like I went on and coached with him. I went to North Melbourne when he was there, and I went to Melbourne with him and coached with him for 5-6 years. We were in business in the hotel together, and, you know, still good, very good friends today. Yeah, so, you know, that was what Barras was like then. I mean, he was magnificent. I mean, you could have a disagree with me. That's one. But Sid Wood, Croswell used to argue over a cup of tea or something, you know, at training, and Croswell played in 4 premierships under Ron Barassi at different clubs, and then followed him to Melbourne, and they'd fight every day.
He was a glutton for punishment. Well, Brett, clearly.
Well, it showed that Barras, look, He was just great. I mean, you know, like, because you could express yourself, and he would talk, and he'd never hold grudges. You know, he's so honest, brutally honest. So again, I mean, reflecting back on that, in that situation, it was just me being a little bit silly, I might say, yeah, Tony.
Now, Adrian, you mentioned a career briefly with Footscray. Your last game was the 72 grand final, which is quite incredible. And then you went to Footscray, you played one game at North and was all over. You then dabbled in the media. You know, you were with the Sporting Globe, you mentioned earlier, and you worked with Radio 3EZ. You had a great empathy for the story. And then you were again involved in football. I think you had time with Barras at Melbourne.
Yes.
But you came back to Carlton, I think, when David Parkin assumed control the second time around, and you were in the box for the last premiership of 95.
Yeah, it was a great time. David and Cole Kinnear invited me back to be a member of the match committee, and it was something that, you know, going back as a many years, you know, like it was such a great honour to do that. And the one thing I had to do was give up my media career, you know, because Colo was Carltoner, have always had a bit of a different relationship with the media, you know, over some period. So that was one rule there. But for 10 years, yeah, with David, and culminating in that one in 95, I mean, that was just a magnificent year. I mean, it was fantastic, and all Carlton supporters will remember it. And the point is, you know, it is 2013 now, and it's getting towards 20 years. Like, and as we said previous in the interview, that the winning of 1968, it was 21 years, and Carlton supporters were screaming out for it. So we've got to look forward to the next couple of years, don't you think? And how quickly it goes from 1995. It's amazing.
And in closing, Adrian, there's so much to ask, but again, time's against us. I'd love to ask you this question, though. You still seem today, in 2013, as passionate as you ever were about the club and the game. What do you think Carlton actually means to you?
Well, it's an interesting question. That was because I think it's with all people that you have your different reasons, but it's an interesting one of belonging to to such a great institution. And, you know, I think what you're doing is excellent. You know, the history of the club, I really enjoy that side of it, and reading about those sort of things. So to me, it's the involvement and belonging to such a great institution.
Well, Adrian, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, to hear you reminisce about one of the greatest eras, if not the greatest era in Carlton history. All power to you, and let's not have to wait 21 years for the next one.
Absolutely, Tony.